This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
We started off the new year with a breakup of sorts because on January 1st, the Singapore government confirmed that the high-speed rail bilateral agreement with Malaysia had been terminated.
If you remember, actually, this is something that's been in the conversations for 10 years. I believe it was in the 2010 economic transformation plan that this was first mooted. The KL-Singapore-HSR bilateral agreement was signed in 2016, but the construction for it was suspended back in September 2018.
So this came out because, because it was time to, really. It was expiring. And Lee Hsien Loong and Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin met via video conference on the 2nd of December to review the status, including changes proposed by Malaysia. We'll come back to that soon. And in a separate statement after that, they said that, well, the two countries just were unable to reach an agreement over the proposed changes, which is where things get quite interesting.
So they said that the changes proposed by Putrajaya were in view of the state of Malaysia's economy, so specifically the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic last year. So Malaysia's deficit this year is expected to skyrocket to 6% from an initial target of 3.2%. So as a result of that, Singapore's Transport Minister Ong Ye Kung said that one of the main concerns for Singapore was that Malaysia proposed to remove a company called Assets Co. from the agreement, and that would have been the system supplier and network operator for the project. So the Minister of Transport, Singapore's Minister of Transport, said that this was a fundamental departure from the original agreement.
So another point of contention would have been that the HSR be extended to include KLIA. So now the conversation is also moving on to how much compensation will Malaysia have to pay in light of the fact that Singapore has already spent more than $270 million on the project. We have had a minister on our side, Dato' Sri Mustafa Mohamed, minister in the Prime Minister's Department, saying that it's going to be much lower than that, but the matter hasn't been finalised and will be discussed soon. So this is a somewhat contentious issue, right? Some people viewed it as a bad idea to begin with. Others are saying that we stand to lose quite a lot from exiting it. Let us know. I mean, would you have wanted to see the high-speed rail in the country? What do you make of its cancellation and the proposed changes? You can call us 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio. We're now crossing over, though, to Dr. Timothy Wong, who is a lecturer with the Department of Economics at the National University of Singapore. Timothy, thanks for speaking with us. So what impact would a HSR between Malaysia and Singapore have had? Let's start with the economic value first.
So I've not been able to find publicly available, credible numbers of what the economic value of this high-speed rail line would be. But we know what the benefits are, and if we think about what the specific benefits are, it'll give us a sense of what the numbers would be. So let's start with the primary benefits. The first benefit being benefits from time savings. We all know that time is money, so the less time you spend traveling, the more time there is for other things like work and leisure. And so the high-speed rail line will be faster than both flying and driving, and in this regard, there are monetary or economic benefits from the high-speed rail line. If you want to do some back-of-the-envelope calculations, let's suppose that the time savings is about an hour, and we can talk some more about what those time savings will look like later. But in the absence of more precise estimates, economists typically value an hour of travel time saved at about half the hourly wage rate, which for people who work in the Klang Valley, half of your hourly wage rate would approximately be on average about 25 ringgit. The high-speed rail line is estimated to carry about 15 million passengers in 2030. So if you put all those numbers together, you're looking very crudely at 375 million ringgit in savings just from time savings, right? And this is, I think, a low estimate because it ignores the fact that some of the passengers will be Singaporeans with higher wages and so higher value on the time savings. And there may be more than an hour of time savings per passenger. And so we're looking at time-saving benefits in the order of hundreds of millions of ringgit each year. But beyond that, there are also other gains, another sizable one being safety gains, because it's much safer to move people from point to point in trains than it is to move them using cars. because there are far higher accident rates in cars, and these accidents are deadly. So the benefits from reducing the number of fatal accidents on the road, each fatal accident is valued in the millions of ringgit. And so we will see millions of ringgit in savings there as well. And then there are smaller benefits that come from increase in comfort and travel time reliability, because typically trains are more comfortable than planes and cars, and they're also more reliable. There's less congestion and relative to planes and cars. So there are benefits there as well. But those are just the primary benefits. In addition, there are secondary benefits that come from the increase in economic activity that results from better transport links between these two cities.
So could you explain what those secondary benefits are?
So, for example, companies in KL can more easily do business with companies in Singapore and vice versa. So the decrease in travel time enables workers who need to travel between the two cities to be more efficient. Workers may be more willing to travel to the other city to conduct business, to look for new markets to sell their products with this improved mode of transport. So from these increased trips, we may also see new business ideas forming between Malaysians and Singaporeans, and this will spur the economy further. One of the biggest benefits of living in a city and connecting cities that are close by to each other is that new interactions create new ideas, and new ideas create innovation, and innovation increases the economic activity within economies. And we call all of this in academic terms agglomeration. There are estimates out there about how increases in transport speeds improve productivity due to agglomeration, and the one academic estimate I'm pulling out here suggests that a 10% improvement in travel speeds will result in a 2-3% gain in productivity. So the high-speed rail line is much faster than, provides much more than a 10% increase in speed. So we're also looking at sizable benefits due to agglomeration. But one caveat that I think is worth mentioning is that because of COVID, some of these numbers are going to change. We should anticipate less business travel since people have adapted to virtual communication, and virtual communication technology has improved rapidly because of the pandemic. So people who we would previously have thought would have benefited from this high-speed rail line, they may not need to use it as intensely because now they can just contact the person in the other city over the internet and reap the productivity gains without actually traveling. So there are some slight decreases in the benefits to agglomeration that come from the fact that a post-COVID world is not the same as a pre-COVID world.
And what different interests would Singapore and Malaysia have respectively from the project?
In many ways, the interests are the same. Both countries want to integrate the economies of their cities together. But it seems that the interests are different in the sense that Malaysia is taking a more nationalistic approach to the construction of the project than Singapore is. That is, they care more about the participation of local firms in the construction of the line.
Right. And on that cancellation, maybe you could also talk us through the proposed changes that came from Malaysia that ultimately Singapore just couldn't, you know, truck with.
I think there is one major change that was a deal breaker for Singapore, and that is that Malaysia no longer wanted to jointly develop the line with Singapore. The initial agreement that was signed a few years ago called for a jointly owned asset company that would call for an international tender to develop the line. So both Malaysia and Singapore would decide together who wins the tender for this line, and that tender would be posted to anybody in the world. Malaysia no longer wants to have a jointly owned asset company with Singapore. Instead, they want to make the decision unilaterally. And the reason for that is they want to be able to prioritize local firms in the construction of the line, which unsurprisingly is something Singapore cannot agree to, because a portion of the line would be on Singapore land, and they're not willing to give up say on what happens on their own land. Malaysia's justification for wanting to unilaterally decide on the developer of the project is that local firms could do it cheaper. But my sense is when Mustafa Mohamed, the minister who said this, made the statement, that it's probably because local firms will do it cheaper, but according to different specifications. Because if the local firms could, in fact, do it cheaper than the international firms, then they could just compete and put in a bid along with the other international firms when the tender was called, and they would win the bid because they were more cost effective. So I think the reason why these local firms are able to do it cheaper is because Malaysia is looking to change the specifications to ones that are not up to the standard that Singapore is requiring. The fact is that Malaysia wants to terminate the assets company because, one, it wants to prioritize local firms, or two, it wants to step down the specifications of the project so that its local firms can be more competitive. And I think Singapore is not on board with that decision.
So for bilateral infrastructure projects like these, what are some additional considerations that governments have to make in comparison to ones that they do within their own borders?
Yeah, so as I've mentioned earlier, the one important takeaway from this bilateral agreement that failed is that it's very difficult to push nationalistic interests when it comes to a bilateral agreement because the other country has little interest in those types of stakes. But another big challenge that I think showed up in the fact that this project failed is the difference in demographics. Singapore is richer, willing to spend more on the high-speed rail line, and I think it's the Singaporean citizens maybe have different expectations from the Malaysian citizens on how much is spent and what the quality of the service should be like. So I think that really is the main source of the breakdown here. The pandemic has really stretched Malaysia's finances, forcing it to borrow much more in 2020 and 2021 than it initially anticipated. We've seen credit ratings have fallen. Malaysia has much less room to embark on large projects that require further borrowing. So all of Malaysia's suggestions, wanting to unilaterally make decisions, wanting to prioritize local firms, all of that, I think, was an effort to lower the cost of the project. And Singapore, because it has sufficient finances to fund the project, doesn't want a lower cost project. They want to stick to the initial agreement, which was more expensive. So that's another consideration. When the financial circumstances of the two parties are too disparate, then a breakdown can occur between the two parties.
So with all that said, are there winners and losers from this cancellation?
Oh, definitely. So the biggest winners here, I think, are the airline companies. They will continue now to provide the quickest mode of transport between the two cities in the absence of high-speed rail. In a time where airlines are trying to borrow money to stay afloat, I think this is some welcome relief to them, knowing that the KL-Singapore route, which is quite lucrative to them, will continue to be a moneymaker for many more years since this high-speed rail is not coming online anytime soon. The losers are the business travelers between KL and Singapore because they won't have a better option of traveling between the two cities. They'll have to settle for flying.
So would there actually have been a way to salvage the deal before this? You were saying earlier that on Malaysia's side, finances were a problem. Could there have been a renegotiation of sorts where Singapore pays for a larger part of the HSR first and then we pay back after, for example?
I mean, that I think is a possibility. They could have worked out a financing agreement where Singapore took on more of the loans in the beginning and Malaysia took them on later on. But I think the fact of the matter is, and this is trajectory in Malaysia since the last election, is they're looking to lower the cost that they put in for infrastructure in general. We saw that with the rail transit link between JB and Singapore that was downsized. And so I think Malaysia's intention here was to lower the cost of the project. And I think that was not something Singapore could do. I don't think Malaysia was open to the idea of just postponing their debt to a later point in time.
So, Timothy, are there lessons that we can learn from other countries that do have a high-speed rail?
I think the biggest lesson is that it's not a surefire success. I've spent a lot of time outlining the benefits that we get from high-speed rail, but the reality is that the costs are still very high. High-speed rail lines are very expensive to build. The most famous story is the one between the high-speed rail link between London and Paris that goes underneath the English Channel. When it first opened, it struggled to sustain itself. More recently, we have Taiwan's high-speed rail company, when it first opened, struggled to recoup its costs and almost went bankrupt. So we need to remember that though the benefits are clear and large, that the costs are also high, and so we shouldn't be too enthusiastic about high-speed rail that we end up building it too early. So London and Paris and Taiwan, in all of these cases, the lines are sustainable now, but they just opened too early, so they built them too soon. And that's an important lesson that we need to bear in mind, especially now in this COVID world. The fact of the matter is that I think this is not a sort of end of the road for high-speed rail between KL and Singapore, because 10, 20, 30 years from now, there will be demand for a high-speed rail project. And so maybe it fails now, but I think it's possible that the two countries will revisit the construction of this type of line in the future.
Timothy, thank you so much for speaking with us. That was Dr. Timothy Wong, lecturer with the Department of Economics at the National University of Singapore, discussing the cancellation of the KL or of the Malaysia-Singapore high-speed rail bilateral agreement. And basically the countries just couldn't come to any sort of agreement, especially with the proposed changes on our end.
Yeah, and I think despite the fact that this is a project that there were many people who were in support of it, particularly in terms of allowing faster travel, supposedly cheaper travel, I think the fact that COVID was a wrench that no one saw coming is a very relevant point. And Timothy mentioned that as well. And possibly it sets things back quite a bit. And that's something that needs to be taken into account when it comes to what Malaysia can afford and what is important right now.
So I think also, we do have a message here from Shane, who says, you know, improve the KTM line, focus on inner city travel, because Penang, Kuching and JB don't have an MRT yet.
That's a great point. There are many things within our borders that need attending to. I mean, we've been talking about potholes, for instance. There are many problems that need to be resolved that I think might seem more pressing to some people.
Yes. I think that's true. Although I do wonder at the loss of business opportunity or at the other opportunities, because I know that Johor State, for example, has said that this is essentially going to be a huge problem for them. We'll see. I think what remains to be seen is also how much we're going to have to pay in terms of compensation.
I think that will be a big factor in terms of how willing people are to be okay with this.
Yes. So we'll return to this as and when we know more. In the meantime, here's the 7:30 news, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my, BFM 89.9, the business station.